organizations as a possible source of counterintelligence against the Soviet Union. CIA documents that just recently have been declassified show strong ties between U.S. intelligence and Ukrainian nationalists since 1946. From the CIA agency report, it is clear that they were not mistaken about the nature of Ukrainian nationalist organizations or their leader, Stepan Bandera himself. By 1954, the agency excused the illegal activities of the OUN security branch in the name of Cold War necessity. In 1949, Mykola Lebed, the man responsible for the massacres in Volhynia, was moved to the United States, where he died in 1989 without ever being investigated or pursued as a war criminal. The CIA moved to protect Ukrainian nationalist leader Mykola Lebed from criminal investigation by the Immigration and Naturalization Service in 1952. The Cold War would heat up and cool down by turns, while both rivals were obsessively building up military capacity. The turning point took place when the new era, Perestroika, came to the USSR with its new leader Mikhail Gorbachev in the middle of the 1980s. Perestroika meant restructuring towards liberalization and democratization. It certainly had a positive impact on the international situation.
Astonishing news from East Germany, where the East German authorities have said, in essence, that the Berlin Wall doesn't mean anything anymore.
But inside the USSR, the weakening of Kremlin control had different consequences. The people's growing discontent made Ukraine more vulnerable to outside forces, and a new kind of warfare was launched, one not known before, the color revolutions.
Violent clashes erupted in the Ukrainian capital Kiev as more than 100,000 people protested against a government decision to delay an association deal with the EU.
Arseniy Yatsenyuk, leader of the opposition party, Fatherland. Oleg Tagnibok, leader of the opposition nationalist far-right political party, Svoboda. Vitaly Klitschko, leader of the opposition party, UDAR. Robert Perry is a longtime investigative journalist based in Washington, D.C., best known for his major disclosures about the Iran-Contra scandal in the 1980s. He is the founder of Consortium News, where he has reported extensively on the crisis in Ukraine and the forces behind the unrest.
An NGO is a non-governmental organization. Now, many NGOs are quite legitimate. They represent good causes. Maybe they help people in a country feed or deal with water problems or deal with various kinds of social problems. But there are some NGOs that have become funded by government entities and serve more the purpose of that government rather than trying to serve the people that they are ostensibly working for. One thing we saw in the 1980s, at that point, the Central Intelligence Agency had been largely discredited because of scandals that had been exposed in the 1970s.
For 15 years, the CIA has secretly financed overseas activities of the National Students Association. But then there came to light a fantastic web of CIA penetrations.
So when the Reagan administration came in, there was this concept that instead of having the CIA, which traditionally would go into these different target countries, funding their media, funding NGOs, funding different political operations, that was essentially farmed out to a new organization called the National Endowment for Democracy, which was created in 1983. And it would do pretty much what the agency used to do. It would go into one of these countries and it would support various political groups, train activists, deal with journalists, business groups, and try to advance U.S. foreign policy interests, sometimes against the interests of the host government, the target government. And beyond that, they received financial and other logistical help from the National Endowment for Democracy and other U.S. agencies that helped them training activists, working with journalists to get their side presented more favorably. They work on things like, how do you get traction? How do you get things to go viral? How do you then use that to generate support for your cause?
And support was generated.
Mustafa Nayem,
a founder of one of Ukraine's new media outlets, Gromadske TV, knew very well how to make something go viral. It was his notorious Facebook post on November 21st, 2013, that brought the first crowds to Maidan. If you don't read the newspaper, you are uninformed. If you read the newspaper, you are misinformed. To deliver your message efficiently enough in the modern world with so many different technologies and means of communications, you must embrace them all. As the disturbing events of Euromaidan started on November 21st, 2013, three new TV channels went on the air and suddenly became stunningly popular in Ukraine. Spilno TV, November 21st. Romatske TV, November 22nd. And Espresso TV, November 24th, directly from opposition protest. These channels went viral, supporting the protests and encouraging more and more people to come to Maidan. November 30th of 2013 became the first turning point of Euromaidan and one of its most reported and mysterious events.
After riot police attacked peaceful protesters with clubs.
Happened in the early morning hours. The eyewitnesses that were there said that the police did use truncheons.
Coincidentally, Sergei Lovochkin is a close associate to many U.S. politicians. The security service of Ukraine had evidence that on that night, Lovochkin was in contact with opposition leader Yatsenyuk, where they discussed the clearing of Maidan on the pretext of installing the annual Christmas tree. News media reported that the riot police cruelly attacked the students peacefully sleeping in their tents, but scenes from the event seem to tell a different story. It appears that the protesters were waiting for the police. Additionally, there were dozens of journalists and cameramen from all the new public TV news outlets prepared to cover the events. And most ominously, a group of well-trained young men arrived to Maidan almost simultaneously with the riot police. They infiltrated the crowd and began provocations with insults, stones, and torches.
The riot sector in Ukraine represents a part of the Ukrainian population that has often favored fairly extreme right-wing positions. They had militias that came especially during the Maidan protests. There were groups that were being shipped into Kiev where they would provide the muscle, in effect, for the demonstrations. So the demonstrations went from being relatively peaceful political protests to being increasingly violent.
The first step in any detective work is to establish a motive. It is now said that Sergei Lovochkin is held in high esteem by his powerful U.S. friends. Outraged by what was reported in the news, the Ukrainian people came out in force on the next day to vent their anger with the police actions. As veiled and masked as the color revolutions can be, an attentive viewer can see subtle patterns and similarities revealing their true nature. To make crowds act as one obedient group, they have to be united at the unconscious level. The masterminds of color revolutions know this well and have perfected the art. Symbolism is one of the most powerful tools to achieve this end. Revolutionary political organizations with surprisingly similar names and even more similar logos have appeared time and again, almost as omens marking the countries that would be hit by the colored plague next. They are often described as being aware and active when they're actually trained and radical. They are the ones who take the first shot, literal and metaphorical, to transform the peaceful protests into full-blown coup d'etats. Their fingerprints can be found everywhere on the map of the color revolutions. Using all the experience of past generations, simple but effective tools like catchy sing-alongs and chanting are employed. Well known for exciting the crowd and creating a group identity, they depersonalize individuals and make them easier to manipulate. Incidentally, one such organization, Romatske TV, received generous donations from the Dutch and U.S. embassies, as well as from the Renaissance Foundation, an NGO founded by George Soros.
I set up a foundation in Ukraine before Ukraine became independent of Russia. And the foundation has been functioning ever since. And it played an important part in events now.
I like criticism, but it must be my way.
We will be back here on this square to celebrate with you a Ukraine that stands with Europe and stands with the United States.
Well, members of Congress were visiting Ukraine during that period, most famously Congressman John McCain. So some of the people who were challenging their government, their elected government at that point, were being told by the senior U.S. official, a person who ran for president and a top official in the U.S. Congress, that the U.S. was with them.
I'm Senator John McCain, and it's always a pleasure to be back in Ukraine.
Senator McCain was, in a sense, giving the people in the Maidan a feeling that they had the backing of the most powerful country on earth.
This is about the future you want for your country. This is about the future you deserve.
In early February of 2014, as the Maidan crisis was getting more violent, there was a phone call that was intercepted. It was a call between the Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, Victoria Nuland, and the U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Jeffrey Pyatt.
Questions of credibility are being raised after a private chat between two top U.S. diplomats was leaked online.
I think Yats is the guy who's got the economic experience, the governing experience. He's the guy, you know, what he needs is Klitsch and Tony Book on the outside. I just think Klitsch going in, he's going to be at that level working for Yatsenyuk. It's just not going to work.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Okay. Good. Well, do you want us to try to set up a call with him as the next step?
Sullivan's come back to me VFR saying you need Biden, and I said probably tomorrow for an attaboy and to get the deets to stick. So
okay.
Biden's willing.
So you had this remarkable phone call where you have these two senior officials of the U.S. government apparently talking about a coup or how they were planning to restructure the government of Ukraine. I'm not saying the whole U.S. government feels that way. There is division on this, but the neoconservative element wants very much to change the strategic dynamic in Eastern Europe. The neocons are very smart people, and they've been at this for a long time. They came in around the issue of propaganda. They studied how to create hot buttons for the American people. They had this experience when they were getting the American people to get excited about Central America back in the 1980s. And they've been applying those same strategies ever since. They remain very dedicated to achieving their goals. They still want to get rid of certain governments. They wanted regime change in Syria, for instance, regime change in Iran. They're very skilled at this, and they have a lot of allies now inside the news media, inside the government, and that means that they can do a lot to control the narrative of any story.
I think in America these days, we have somehow told ourselves that there are a lot of ways of dealing with these problems other than hard power. Vladimir Putin cares about hard power.
The neoconservatives can now demonize a leader of a country. That sells with the American people. So you don't just sort of argue a policy. You attack the leader. So the neoconservatives became very skilled at picking out leaders, finding their ugly traits, and then highlighting them. Yanukovych, you might say, was a rather clunky political leader, but you make him into a devil. He's totally corrupt, and he's evil, and he wants to kill people in the Maidan, these wonderful white-hatted demonstrators. So you've got a black hat versus white hat. You keep repeating that basic scenario, and it works with the American people.
You've got to realize what Vladimir Putin is. He's an old KGB colonel that wants to restore the Russian Empire.
You make them into demons, and the American people find that the way they can understand the world. Once that happens, it's very difficult for a journalist or anyone else to say, you know, hold it, that guy, he's kind of more of a gray hat than a white hat or a black hat. And if you say that, you suddenly are you're a Yanukovych apologist or you're a Putin apologist, and then the attacks come on to the person saying it, the journalist, the academic, or whoever.
Any good director will tell you that tempo and rhythm are the most essential components to hold an audience's attention. It can also be called a method of betrayal when the allies and followers are relentlessly thrown into the revolutionary flame. The idea is simple. When the preparation work is done, the trigger just needs to be pulled to set the machine into full motion. the murder of politician Rafiq Hariri led to the Cedar Revolution. Looking back at the mysterious poisoning of Viktor Yushchenko right before the Orange Revolution of 2004, we see now that he became a sacred victim himself. Most political analysts believe the compassion of the Ukrainian people at that moment tilted the scales, giving him the presidency. The number of victims among the protesters during Euromaidan totaled over 100. They are called the Heavenly Hundred. All the sacred victims were immediately mythologized. The beating of students on November 30th, 2013 was the obvious trigger of Euromaidan. Those who sent trained provocateurs to the square very well realized that peaceful protesters were the ones who would get hurt the most. It's hard to keep protests going for months on end. Tensions subside, and people inevitably get tired. Holidays are also a big danger for revolutionary masterminds. People want to be home with their families and friends, and one needs to get inventive to keep people in a cold, tense city. On Christmas Day of 2013, tabloid journalist and political wannabe Tatiana Chornovol was chosen to become the tool to whip the protests on Maidan back up.
A civic activist and journalist known for investigating corruption among senior officials was beaten outside Ukraine's capital on Christmas.
Her heroic deeds as a reporter looked more like petty crimes, trespassing on the presidential residence of Viktor Yanukovych, leading a rioting crowd to seize the Kiev City Administration building, breaking into a car of the Security Service of Ukraine. It looked like Tatiana was more interested in making news than reporting it, and gaining name recognition that could be turned into votes for her struggling political career in the opposition party Fatherland. She gave the world media a Christmas present in 2013, when she was cruelly beaten by unknown assailants on the road. Despite the fact that in just 3 days all the suspects were arrested and confessed to beating Tatiana during a road rage incident, world media kept insisting upon the political background of the crime. Instantaneously, Tatiana became a heroic martyr, uniting people around her image.
The beating, coming amid political turmoil in Ukraine, this has drawn a protest.
Euromaidan was once again center stage, and Tatiana, in less than 2 months after the assault, she was already healthy enough to attack the office of Party of Regions, the party of Viktor Yanukovych. One of the staff members, 65-year-old IT specialist Vladimir Zaharov, was killed during the attack. So, where is Tatiana now? Well, she finally got her position of power in the new government. 1 month later, the time for another act in the play came. Armenian-Ukrainian protester Sergei Nigoyan was one of the first to arrive at Maidan. He wasn't radical or violent, but instead naive and full of hope. Watching Sergei read a patriotic poem is like watching a casting tape for the role of a sacred victim. Unfortunately, Sergei got the part. Betrayed by his brothers in arms, this video would eventually go viral after Sergei was killed early in the morning of January 22, 2014. The circumstances of his death remain unknown to this day. Even though the whole area of protests was heavily filmed at that time, there were no records or witnesses to help the investigation, and his body was moved immediately from the scene of the crime. Sergei became the first killed martyr of Euromaidan, and in a heartbeat, the police officers were appointed as his killers. Almost 2 years later, the official investigation would still deliver no results. Now, it is widely believed that Nigoyan's murder was staged by provocateurs to escalate the conflict. God speaks to people with the language of signs. On January 26, 2014, Pope Francis prayed for Ukraine, addressing thousands of people at St. Peter's Square in Vatican City.
et Filius et Spiritus Sanctus.
After the prayer, two white doves were released from the papal window and were immediately attacked by a crow and seagull. Those who understand the language could easily read the meaning of this omen. Soon, great forces, the seagull and the crow, would be tearing apart two Slavic nations, the white doves. This omen gave hope to the Ukrainian people, saying that by God's will, the doves would be saved. But it also predicted severe hardship and many victims. The events which could enter into the history of the color revolutions as the most massive human sacrifice yet arrived right on schedule, 1 month later. And here again we meet our old acquaintance from Narodny Rukh, Andriy Paruby, who is at the peak of his glory as self-proclaimed commandant of Maidan, which basically means the leader of the radical opposition.
The protesters were filmed leading a long line of riot police away. It's not clear where they were taking them. 67 officers are currently reported to be missing.
14 policemen dead and 43 wounded.
Earlier, from inside the protest camp, the opposition leader Vitali Klitschko urged his supporters to stay put. "Each of you here should stay strong in spirit," he said, "because we're not going anywhere."
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
BlackRock is one of the world's biggest corporate drivers of climate chaos and ecocide. Stay with us for an article in this regard written jointly by Yusra Bitar and Ali Shah, writers. This article is published under the heading "War Profiteering, Ecocide and Policing: BlackRock Vies for Corporate Hall of Shame." Stay tuned for more. BlackRock, the world's biggest asset management firm, has been nominated for the 2022 Corporate Hall of Shame at Corporate Accountability. BlackRock has nearly $10 trillion in assets under management. That's more than the GDP of every country in the world except for the United States and China. BlackRock is a top shareholder across a wide range of global industries that include oil and gas, technology, retail, big banks, healthcare, weapons manufacturing, and much more. And this makes BlackRock one of the most powerful corporate actors on the planet, whose influence touches every aspect of daily lives. BlackRock's founder, chairman, and CEO Larry Fink has attempted to brand the firm as sensitive to global challenges like climate change, structural racism, and public health. However, BlackRock's investment activity and governance practices drive business operations that directly harm Black and Indigenous communities and people of color around the world. The firm props up the fossil fuel industry to the tune of $260 billion in investments in corporations that are propelling climate catastrophe. It has nearly $6 billion invested in civilian gun manufacturers and retailers and an astounding $36 billion invested in military's weapons companies. Larry Fink has been a major donor to the New York City Police Foundation, which supplies equipment and surveillance technology to New York Police Department that has targeted black and brown communities in New York for decades. For all these reasons and more, BlackRock has been nominated to join Corporate Accountability's Corporate Hall of Shame, and we believe it is an extremely strong candidate for entry. BlackRock is one of the world's biggest corporate drivers of climate chaos and ecocide. Not only is it a major culprit behind the global climate breakdown because of its huge fossil fuel investments, but its wishy-washy climate promises and support for false climate solutions fail to address the root causes of the climate crisis. To start, BlackRock oversees one of the world's biggest fossil fuel portfolios. It is a top owner of the world's most powerful and most polluting oil and gas corporations, from ExxonMobil to Chevron and from ConocoPhillips to Marathon Petroleum. It recently led a consortium of investors that plowed $15.5 billion into Aramco, Saudi Arabia's state-owned oil and gas company and one of the world's dirtiest fossil fuel companies. BlackRock also remains one of the world's biggest investors in the coal industry. While insurance and investment for the coal industry is shrinking, BlackRock has recently plunged more than $34 billion into companies developing new coal assets. BlackRock remains the single largest institutional investor in coal, with around $109 billion invested in the industry. This includes the $1.2 billion BlackRock invested in Adani Group's dirty coal mine project in Australia, which over 100 companies have ruled out investing in due to public pressure. Not BlackRock, though. Simply put, there are few corporate actors that are more heavily invested and have more of an ownership share in fossil fuels and extractive industries like BlackRock. This also means that BlackRock has more power than almost anyone when it comes to holding these industries to account for the damage they cause. But does BlackRock use this power for good? Not even close. While BlackRock is financing the fossil fuel industry whose operations are harming frontline communities around the world, CEO Larry Fink has also been supporting the police as they target protesters and BIPOC communities in BlackRock's home city of New York. Larry Fink served as the co-chair of New York City Police Foundation's annual gala for 4 years beginning in 2016, and he was honored by the foundation in 2015. Fink has also donated to the NYC Police Foundation, which has given millions to the New York Police Department, NYPD, for more surveillance equipment, mounted police horses, and policing gear. In 2020, the NYPD used excessive force to crack down on racial justice protesters after George Floyd was murdered by police in Minneapolis. In fact, the state of New York filed a lawsuit against the NYPD over their handling of the protest. In 2020, of course, the suit claims that the New York City Police Department exhibited a pattern of using excessive force and making false arrests against New Yorkers during peaceful protests. BlackRock's support of police power in the United States extends far beyond just as New York City. Thank you. As Code Pink has reported, BlackRock is the largest shareholder in Axon, a nationwide supplier of tasers, body cameras, and surveillance software to police departments around the U.S. BlackRock holds 10.4% of Axon's stock, which currently amounts to over $600 million invested in the company. In addition to being the largest shareholder, former chief investment officer at BlackRock, Matthew McBrady, has served on the board of Axon since 2016. Axon has contracts with the police departments in most major cities in the United States. The company's flagship products are a series of tasers that are sold to civilians, police, and the military. The company claims that the weapon is a safer alternative than guns for police to use in the field. However, a 2019 Reuters report documented a total of at least 1,081 U.S. deaths following use of tasers in the U.S. since they became widely popular with police departments in early 2000s. Another report from USA Today found that 4 of 5 cases that ended in death that involved tasers began as calls for nonviolent incidents, and 84% were unarmed. In the cases where the race of the victim was reported, the majority were Black or Latino. Nevertheless, the NYPD stockpiled the brand new X26P tasers from Axon in 2020. The Los Angeles Police Department followed suit in 2021 by purchasing 5,260 Taser 7 energy weapons from Axon, making the LAPD the force with the largest energy weapon deployment in the U.S. Since 2018, the company has also entered into agreements to supply hundreds of tasers to major cities including Chicago, San Jose, Tucson, St. Louis, and Pittsburgh. BlackRock has directly benefited from Axon's 220% growth in the last 5 years. BlackRock is also the largest investor in gun manufacturer Smith & Wesson, with an 8.3% stake in the company. Smith & Wesson guns or ammunition are used in the police departments in New York City, Los Angeles, Houston, Detroit, and Chicago. The company also makes assault weapons and restraints marketed and sold to police departments. In addition to profiting off of bloated police budgets, BlackRock also props up many companies whose products are tied to gun violence in the United States and endless war and occupation of places like in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Palestine. BlackRock is a top investor in many gun and weapons manufacturers that sell weapons designed to kill people as efficiently as possible, with consequences that are hard to ignore. BlackRock's investments in weapons manufacturers also equip and profit from war machines across the world that create massive refugee crises. In yet another attempt to distance itself from the harm tied to its business operations, BlackRock just announced a new partnership with the International Rescue Committee, IRC, to help refugees displaced by war in Afghanistan. However, as Code Pink reports, BlackRock maintains sizable investments in some of the largest weapons manufacturers in the world, who are directly profiting from arms sales tied to many of the wars that are creating refugee crises. BlackRock has tens of billions invested in the top military contractors in the United States. It is a top beneficial owner of Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Northrop Grumman, and Raytheon. BlackRock executives and governors also have interlocking roles with these defense manufacturers. For example, Boeing director Stace D. Harris is also a director of BlackRock's fixed income mutual funds. BlackRock also owns hundreds of millions of dollars worth of shares in a range of smaller gun and weapons manufacturers. A few examples include Vista Outdoors, which sells ammunition, primers, and powder directly to consumers in addition to law enforcement and the military. BlackRock is a 15.26% owner of Vista, $307.7 million stake at the time of the most recent filing. Olin Corporation, a manufacturer of ammunition and chemical products that also owns Winchester Ammunition, the largest military. BlackRock owns 10.4% of Olin and $825.8 million stake at the time of the most recent filing. Ammo Inc., which supplies ammunition to the U.S. military and the police and is a leading manufacturer of armor-piercing bullets. BlackRock owns 11.26% of Ammo, $27.4 million stake at the time of the most recent filing. National Presto Industries, which owns AMTEC, the largest volume producer of 40mm grenade ammunition and fuzzing in the world, along with several other explosives manufacturers. BlackRock owns 12.52% of National Presto, a $67.9 million stake at the time of the most recent filing. BlackRock is also a top owner of major gun and ammunition retailers like Big Five Sporting Goods and Sportsman Warehouse Holdings. As the world's top asset manager, BlackRock is a majority investor in almost every major publicly traded company. It profits from those companies' operations and, as a major shareholder, bears significant responsibility for their governance and the impacts of their operations across the world.
Çömen. Yani...
Bazaar.
Advanced technologies are all around us. They make modern life possible, saving time, energy, and natural resources. Most commonly, specialized products are made by knowledge-based companies. Iran's expansion of high-tech markets reveals a significant shift towards a knowledge-based economy. This is known as a system of consumption and production that is based on intellectual capital. In particular, it refers to the ability to capitalize on scientific discoveries and applied research.
Oh, hello there, and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. The manufacturing and engineering of Iranian knowledge-based products have grown by leaps and bounds over the years, and we wanted to see what this actually looks like. So this week, we will explore a one-of-its-kind exhibit held in the city of Shiraz in Fars province. We wanted to see what products are out there and why they are so important to industrial development. So, let's check out today's Bazaar.
The International Fairground in Shiraz was transformed into a science and tech lover's dreamland where hundreds of participants from all walks of the industry participated. The exhibit is dubbed Iranian Production and Knowledge-Based Enterprises. It was held in line with the industrial slogan of the year. Top investors, industrial participants, and production companies were invited to participate while shining the spotlight on knowledge-based firms and startups. The expo ran for 4 days in late June. The goal is to use the capacity of knowledge-based companies to increase production in various Iranian industries. These sectors include communications, petrochemical, oil and gas, food, agricultural and medical industries, among others. Here, the connection between science and product development is evident. At the center of it is the intersection of private entrepreneurship, academia, and government-sponsored research. Educational and research institutions were also among participants. The exhibit was held with the cooperation of the private and government sectors. It's an opportunity for identifying the sector needs, and like other expos, it displays Iran's vast capabilities. You can find almost anything here, from robotics used in the medical sector to advanced machines used in the petrochemical industries. Tens of thousands of exciting and unique products were displayed. Some were recent inventions being showcased for the first time.
Since I returned back to my country, my homeland, I started developing this multi-engineering disciplines of science based on the ideas I had from the startup studios which we had faced in Silicon Valley in San Francisco. Medis Holding especially is working on design and developing technologies in software, hardware, informatics, and robotics. We've got more than 27 projects in a variety of fields. More than 8 of them are in the market, and 15 of them are scientifically approved by the Vice Presidency of Science. And basically, what we've got in this symposium is presenting ourselves, presenting our infrastructure, and showing us as a technology pioneer of south of Iran. We've got the most powerful, actually, supercomputing center with more than power, 160 teraflops of computing power. We've got design in robotic systems. We've got this humanoid robot named Stella, based on human anatomy, and lots of variety of projects in different ways. So this is all what I can say and what I can talk about the main aspects of Medis Holding. This symposium is quite active. What I like about it is that there are the new generation of startup studios are around, and scientific people, especially from the university, and those who want to interconnect universities with industry are around, and we've got good impact on it. And I really liked it. I really enjoyed it.
Such exhibits are booming with ideas and energy. These gatherings allow companies to assess the needs of the industries in which they operate. This means they can identify products that need to be developed or find potential commercial markets for items they manufacture. It's a platform for expanding business markets and finding potential customers and suppliers, among other things. Plus, the expo offers chances to link investors with potential joint ventures in various fields. It is a place where companies can recruit young talents too. Moreover, the event is a stage for exchanging knowledge and information while sharing the experiences and capabilities of the participants. This helps serve a broad goal, which is to mix knowledge and production. Applying this blend improves the quality and quantity of products in the market in the long run. Industry participants can also evaluate developments in their sectors and check out local competition by visiting such expos. Another benefit is the presence of government decision makers at such events. Knowledge-related productions have helped the country overcome tough challenges posed by the US-imposed sanctions. Initially, the sanctions were meant to inhibit Iran from doing international business, such as importing essential tech. But with efforts from these firms, market voids have been filled with advanced products that have been entirely locally produced. Consequently, knowledge-based firms have created thousands of products that were previously sanctioned. These products help supply the domestic market and are exported to several destinations abroad, ultimately giving back to the national economy.
Our After seeing such an exhibit, it becomes evident that Iran enjoys the necessary infrastructure to become a major exporter of knowledge-based products and services. Innovation based on research that is commodified via patents and other forms of intellectual property is what really drives the knowledge-based economy. Plus, knowledge-related industries represent a large share of the activity in national development.
The National Chamber of Commerce plans to encourage domestic companies to export their products and increase foreign revenues to $4 billion. Given official and unofficial statistics, exports of these items and services in 2020 were valued at around $1 billion. That's based on figures from the Confederation of Knowledge-Based Associations. The Confederation also reports a 100% increase in new firms in some provinces over the past 8 years. During this period, the export of knowledge-based products increased by 34 times as a result of the government's support for innovations and companies. Many of these firms and startups are active in ICT, software, water management, chemical industry, medicine, space tech, steel, nano and biotechnology, and so much more. So far, Iranian knowledge-based firms have marketed their products in over 70 countries, and in some global markets have overtaken European and American companies. That's according to the National Innovation and Prosperity Fund. Exporting technological products is one of the essential programs of the Office of Science and Technology. To this end, the government has developed and implemented programs and support packages to develop products for export. Some of the schemes are focused on attracting foreign investment, eliciting the participation of Iranians abroad, and connecting domestic capabilities to global markets.
More specifically, the country's knowledge-based ecosystem currently accounts for more than 3% of the national gross domestic product. But the Vice Presidential Office for Science and Technology says the main goal is for this figure to reach 10% of GDP. So, what does the current scene of knowledge-based development look like in the shift toward a knowledge-based economy?
The share of these companies in the country's economy is currently valued at $34 billion since 2019. This shows a 450% growth in knowledge-based productions. That's based on the Vice Presidential Office for Science and Technology data. There are currently around 7,000 knowledge-based companies active in the country, offering advanced products and services in tech fields to domestic and foreign markets. The plan for strengthening domestic knowledge-based companies raises hope for reducing obstacles on the path to domestic development. So, further emphasis has been placed on developing more innovation houses and tech parks nationwide. Also, the government has set up such parks in several other countries to connect Iranian knowledge-based product development to global markets. These centers have already been set up in Russia, Turkey, China and Kenya, just to name a few. On a more micro level, the government has been offering a broad range of services to help knowledge-based companies get established and develop products. Some include providing consultation services, financial aid, and leniency in commercializing products. Others combine services with innovative companies, linking export brokers and foreign traders to these firms. These days, the government is focusing on following up on necessary measures for expanding exports of knowledge-based products overseas.
Okay, it's time for me to take a short break and pass the action over to my good friend and colleague out there in the field.
E-commerce has been growing at a phenomenal rate throughout recent years. With the onset of the pandemic, an economic downturn loomed over companies and businesses on a global scale. However, amid slowing economic progress, the COVID upsurge resulted in an unprecedented spike in digital trade and online retailing. International e-commerce market accounted for 14 and about 17% of overall retail sales consecutively in 2019 and 2020. What's shocking is that figures and numbers in Iran's online retailing system do not seem to be following the same global pattern, even after the pandemic hardly hit our country. An Iranian team, Radar, notices this unusual pattern. Having noticed the problem, they now come up with their own creative idea.
The idea of creation of Radar started about 3 years ago. It was May or June of 2019. I think we noticed a problem in the online retail in Iran. The problem we touched, the problem we noticed was that why the percentage of online retail in Iran never goes higher than 1 or 2%. At the year before, despite of the presence of the coronavirus, this percentage never went higher than 3%. In comparison to the online shopping, online retail in other countries, in China or in European countries, about half of the population do the shopping through the online platforms. In Iran, despite of the presence of technologies like 4G, even 5G technologies for communication, and online platforms, advanced tools that they present to the society, the percentage is the same, 2 or 3%. We did a lot of research, we did a lot of studies, and the only thing we found was that people need to be in connection. People need to be connected, interact with each other, and then decide to buy something online. What we did in Radar, we shift the priorities. The first priority in Radar is interaction of people in, they are in connected with each other. And the second one is the online shopping tools. And this is in this situation that we believe this, that percentage goes higher. If I want to tell you what is Radar, simple way, Radar is a platform fully interactional. People, users are fully connected, are in touch with each other. Sellers can be in touch with the customers. Customers are in touch with the seller. They can chat or talk to each other before every shopping. People are categorized in communities such as students, nurses, doctors, and so on. They can talk to each other, ask, demand, and make a good decision before every shop. Even sellers in this platform can hire their people if they want to employ someone. They can hire through the communities that is there in the Radar itself.
The advantages of the platform, however, do not remain limited to what's been mentioned earlier. Some innovative and revolutionary virtual assets are designed and made accessible to users of the platform.
In Radar, we have some features to be mentioned that are really, really creative and revolutionary. Some of them are named Radarit. In Persian language, we called it Radarishkon or My City or even window shopping. For example, if I want to explain a bit about Radarit, you can send your requests, send your questions to all the sellers around yourself, or in another city or everywhere in your country before you buy a product online. Even you can choose the radius, you can choose the distance, and now he is the seller that should answer to your request. In this way, Radar is an on-demand platform that what matters is what you want, not what is sorted, what is listed in online stores. To explain our next feature in Radar named My City, or let's say in Persian, Shahreman, a society in which people are categorized in communities such as students, nurses, doctors, and so on. They can talk to each other, they can ask questions, answer to each other, and find everything you need to know before you make your online shopping. The next creative and somehow enjoyable feature of Radar is window shopping, or let's say in Persian, Bazargardi. By the use of this feature, you can virtually walk through the online stores and have a look at the products, comparison the prices, and the find what you want to buy online.
Radar is currently providing its services for free to all the retailers, a mission of high value to the whole team.
At last, I want to mention one valuable mission we have chosen for our company. Our mission is somehow interwoven with our CSR or company social responsibility. We promote shops and sellers in our platform for free. We promote them to all the customers in the communities, in the province, and for the whole country. We help them to be visited more and to gain more customers and sell more.
With the potential for rapid growth, Radar is already very serious with its visions for the future. Visions from widening its market to providing the opportunity for international export in the long run.
About our vision in Radar, we have short-term vision, mid-term, and long-term vision. About the short-term vision, we are developing some creative and revolutionary features such as the merchant. We called it in Persian Bazargan. And our mid-term and long-term vision is to deliver and make accessible Radar for the neighbor countries and next to the whole world.
Competing in the retail market on a global scale might not seem like an easy task for an Iranian online platform. But serious with its visions and meticulous with its ambitious plans, Radar seems to be right on its way to fulfill such objectives.
Many thanks for that awesome adventure, as always. Well, we are almost out of time, but before we go, let's look at a couple of news and trends in knowledge-based productions in Iran. Ever wonder where space shuttles get their electricity from? Well, an Iranian scientist has found a way to make energy from a new type of bacteria that can power spaceships.
It's actually a bioreactor that decomposes plastic. The bioreactor was discovered by an Iranian scientist and physician who has won several awards for various scientific breakthroughs. Hamer Milani is known for finding a microorganism that can be used in pharmaceuticals to treat parasites. His discoveries have also been registered in the US National Center for Biotechnology.
Health technology is another area where knowledge-based research has helped Iran advance the sector. In fact, the country has improved its global ranking in this area to show for it.
Based on innovative indicators of health technology development in 2021, the country was ranked 60th among over 130 countries. The ranking is based on the Global Innovation Index by evaluating seven indicators, including institutional structure, human capital and research, and tech knowledge, among others.
Well, that concludes our program for today. I have been Samson Seas. Sees you on the next Bazaar.
We are with you. What about you? CRIB English Radio.
Limelight.